Bonjour and a very warm welcome to the Good Life France podcast. I'm Janine Marsh, your host, and though I'm from London, UK, I now live in France, in the far north, a place called the Seven Valleys in Pas-de-Calais. I have seven cats, four dogs, and several hedgehogs that live under the decking in the back garden and come to the back door for food from spring to early winter. And I also have chickens, ducks, and geese. I write books about France. I'm the editor of the Good Life France magazine and website, and I travel around France throughout the year. And I love to chat to you on this podcast alongside my podcast partner, Olivier Geoffrey.
Bonjour everyone, and yes, a very warm welcome indeed to the podcast, and thank you again so much for all your lovely emails and comments on social media about the podcast. It's so nice to read them, I love them. I'm French and now live in Lyon in the south of France after spending 20 years living in the UK, so that's us. But now, let's talk about today's topic. Janine, tell us what's coming up in this episode.
So today we're going to be talking about something very French. Wine. France is, of course, one of the best winemaking countries in the world.
Pop, and beyond.
You are probably right, Ollie. If there is a beyond, and aliens are out there thinking what wine to have their meal today, it's likely to be French, according to Ollie, at least.
But it won't be the famous wine of Châteauneuf-du-Pape in Provence, because the town has a law that states that UFOs cannot land there at all. Forbidden.
You're absolutely right. It is quite true, actually, that it's bizarre and it's bonkers and it's a brilliant bit of marketing, but it is actually true. UFOs are prohibited from landing in Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
That's amazing. Anyway, that sounds like a great topic. Let's pop some corks and talk wine. The Good Life France podcast. Everything you want to know about France and more. With Janine Marsh and Olivier Geoffrey. So, wine has been made in France for thousands of years. It's said that the first vines were planted by Greek settlers in the south as long ago as 600 years BC. The Romans planted vines too when they arrived in France, some 550 years later. They established such excellent vineyards in Bordeaux that their wine was exported to Roman troops stationed in what is now Britain. Wine, though, is much older than that. Some historians say that the earliest wines go back 8,000 years, where in what is now Georgia, people buried grapes underground to keep them through winter. And voilà, wine was born. Or you can listen to other historians who say wine was made even longer ago than that, based on 10,000-year-old grape pips found near Lake Geneva.
Wow. Well, whoever first invented it, we owe them a debt of gratitude. Yes. And I will happily say a toast to them with my next glass of wine. I have quite a soft spot for wine, for French wine particularly, actually, because it's partly responsible for me living in France. It was on a very cold and sleety February day in 2004 that I went with my dad and my husband by ferry from the south coast of the UK to Calais in France to buy French wine. And that was when I first saw the old French farmhouse that I now call home. It's a long story. You know, you need to listen to episode one of this podcast to find out more.
I think most, if not all, French people have a very soft spot for the wine grown in France. Anyway, we do, of course, consider it to be the best in the world and beyond again. When we drink wine, we treat it with respect, you see. We don't just fill a glass to the top and glug. The wine is poured so that there's enough room for it to breathe. Then it is swirled in the glass to release the vapor, all the better to sniff it. And we talk about what it tastes like a lot.
Yes, you do. Not just you, but every French person I know. I once went to dinner with French friends in a lovely, cozy little restaurant in Burgundy. And it started with a wine tasting and a game. It was actually a board game. And it involved choosing from a bundle of cards, which described the taste of the wine we had. And it included things like leather, flesh, and barnyard, and they all took it really seriously.
Wine is very serious for us French, yes. Apparently around 16% of the French drink wine every day, but we drink a lot less than we used to. In 1975, your average Frenchie drank 100 litres of wine a year. But by 2016, it was 42 litres, and it's still dropping, to be honest. And France is also the world's top exporter of wine.
My first memories of drinking wine were aged 14, and I was living with a French family in Antony in the suburbs of Paris, where I was sent to improve my French language skills. I'm not actually sure it worked, to be honest, but anyway, I was shocked to be offered a small amount of wine, watered down with a Sunday dinner, because that would never have happened back home in London. My parents insisted that there would be no alcohol before the legal age of 18.
Ouch.
And I just remember feeling like, oh, I'm, so grown up to taste wine in France, although I didn't like it at all then.
Now, in France, it's customary to instill in young people a healthy respect and understanding, in a way, of wine earlier, in the belief that it prevents children from wanting to binge drink later on. You might be surprised to learn it was only in 1956 that the French government banned the serving of wine in school canteens.
Sorry, what?
Yeah.
Kids were served wine with their meals at school. Sacrebleu. But yes, I do know this is true because I saw a newspaper article that was published in 1956, and it was about the law banning the serving of wine to school children during school hours. But it was suggested that instead, perhaps they could have cider or beer. Wow.
In France, it's traditional actually to drink wine with food. To know how to pair wine properly is considered a skill, and it's quite normal to go to a wine shop and ask the people who work there to help you to pick a wine to go with the food you're serving. And it's quite normal as well to have a different wine with each course.
And there are, of course, wine snobs in France, as there are in all countries. But on the whole, I do find that the French have quite an academic and really rather respectful attitude to wine that can seem snooty, but actually has nothing to do with snobbery and everything to do with a true appreciation of the quality of the wine.
Thank you for saying that, Janine. French people drink different wines according to the season. Rosé in summer, fresh red wines in autumn, robust reds in winter, and as you say, they drink different wines with different courses. A sweet white wine with foie gras, a crisp white wine with oysters, white wine with fish, red wine with meat, a floral red with creamy cheeses like brie and camembert, sweet wine with dessert, of course, etc. So don't go thinking this is an everyday thing. It's not. That much layering of wine is for special dinners or at a restaurant where a sommelier, a waiter who is trained as a wine expert, chooses wine to go with those courses.
Do you know, I'm always amazed at how wine tastes so different according to what you're eating. I went to Beaujolais a couple of weeks ago and I did 20 wine tastings, which including pairing it with chocolate, cheese and various other foods. And it isn't really entirely about red with this and white with that. It goes a lot deeper. And I love doing these wine tasting tours in France, learning about how it's made, the grape varieties that are used, the histories of the vineyards, the history of the people making the wine. It's a whole cultural thing. It's not just grape juice in a glass.
You're right. It's a whole lot of things. Whether someone is new to wine making or their family have been doing it for centuries, it makes the wine tastes better. Though, it always tastes best when you drink it with friends.
It does. And to me, it's so much more than just a glass of wine. It is about knowing where the wine came from. And absolutely, a bit of provenance makes the wine taste better, I always think. And wherever you go in France, it's always a good idea to stop off at a wine domain, a winery, and hear their stories and taste their wines. I remember going to a place called Les Riceys in Champagne, and I heard the story of how when the Palace of Versailles was being built, King Louis XIV saw some workmen drinking wine, which they said was from their local town, and he apparently went up to them and said, "Oh, can I have a drop?" Like you do if you're king. And they were from Les Riceys and they were drinking rosé from the town. And apparently the king loved it so much that it became known as the pink wine of kings. There you go. And he also loved red wine from Champagne, or Champagne, especially from the aptly named village of Bouzy. I just love that name. A village called Bouzy, only in France.
It's a funny name, yeah. We have a lot of legends about wine in France. In Saint-Émilion, for instance, famous name, they say that on a full moon night, fairies dance among the vineyards and pour a few drops of their magic wine on the vines. This fairy wine is said to have extraordinary properties and to be particularly prized.
Didn't know that. I'm going to ask for fairy wine next time I go to Saint-Emilion. And I hope they don't look at me like I'm crazy, Ollie, you telling me this. I really love the French saying, which applies to a very good wine. I don't know if all French people say this, Ollie, you can tell me in a minute, but my neighbour Jean-Claude always says, oh, c'est le petit jésus en quelque lot de velours, or something like that, which basically means it's baby Jesus in velvet pants, or it's really delicious. Do you ever say that, Ollie?
Nope, I didn't know that saying at all.
Okay, it's just Jean-Claude then. No, but pretty much everyone in my village says that. C'est le
Okay.
petit
It might be a
Jésus
Northern France thing.
en culotte
So in France, we refer to terroir a lot when we're talking about wine and food too, actually, but especially wine. It's a word you can't really translate into English, though it sounds a bit like territory, terroir, territory. But it really means the environmental conditions where something is grown. The weather, how much sun reaches a vineyard, whether it's on a hill, the soil condition, and all sorts of things affect the terroir, which in turn gives wine its unique flavor and aroma.
I visited Burgundy last year and I wanted to find out more about the wines of what is called Les Climats de Burgundy, which basically refers to a group of vineyards which are UNESCO recognised as a cultural landscape. And climat sounds a bit like climate, and you think it would mean that, but it doesn't. So a bit like terroir, it means a lot of things. And in this instance, it refers to specific plots of vines which have a precisely defined border, and each plot produces wine with a unique taste, and each wine bears the name of the plot, and every plot has a unique name. And there are more than 1,200 of these plots, climats, across the entire listed area, which is about 60 kilometres long. So some of these plots are really, really small. And the climats are the result of a combination of 2,000 years of cultural heritage and savoir-faire, the know-how of the growers. And they were often worked by monks in the old days, and generally, you can tell a climat because it has a stone wall around it, which gives the vineyard a name like Clos, Clos, like Clos Bezé, which is a plot known to have been worked by monks 1500 years ago. And there are often little stone shelters in the vineyards. And I think it's just so fascinating, the history of wine. It isn't just making wine, it's a human history as well.
That is completely true, Janine. And also, we have some interesting ways of testing wine. First, you swish the glass around gently before smelling the wine and finally taking a sip. This swishing movement with the glass is to see if the wine will pleure, which means crying, dripping down the glass like teardrops with perfect consistency. If it doesn't cry, s'il ne pleure pas, it's not considered very good wine. We also describe the wine according to its robe, which literally translates as to dress. It's about the color, but also the texture on the tongue.
That is just so French. That is such a French thing. So art de vivre. You don't just go, smells nice, tastes good. You go, it's pleuring, it's crying well, and the robe is divine. Oh la la. Very French. Making wine is an art. But also drinking wine is an art, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you know, the wine tests are so different according to which region you're in. The wines of Haute-Savoie, for instance, are very different from the Bordeaux. The wines of Alsace are different from the Loire Valley. And did you know that there is even a vineyard in the heart of Paris? Yes, Paris, as we know it, actually used to be covered in vineyards in the Middle Ages. And you can still see and visit a vineyard in Paris. It's in Montmartre, of course, rather a secret place. And if you're in Paris in October, they have a vendange, the harvest of the grapes, with a big celebration, big party. There are close to 800,000 hectares of vineyards in France, more than 1 million rugby pitches worth. It's gigantic. Wines are produced in every region of France, even Hauts-de-France, where you live, Janine, the northernmost tip of the country, which is traditional beer country.
You're right. Even champagne is produced in Hauts-de-France, which most people are completely unaware of.
And that leads us nicely to one of the most famous wines of France, Champagne. Champagne can only be produced in a designated area in Champagne, but which spills just a little way over the border into neighboring Picardy in Hauts-de-France, as we just say, where the conditions for champagne production are met. The name Champagne itself is protected, very strongly protected, and only sparkling wine produced in this region of France can be called Champagne. The same goes for the process that assures those trademark bubbles. It's called the méthode champenoise, and only champagne makers in Champagne can claim its use. Other sparkling wines produced in France or elsewhere, in the UK for instance, are produced by the méthode traditionnelle. The Champagne hillsides, houses and cellars are UNESCO listed under the organically evolved living cultural landscapes category. Wow, that's what I call a category.
It's a big category and well deserved. I am a definite champagne fan. And again, there are so many different types of champagne. And talking of bubbles, scientists say that there are around 49 million of them in a single bottle. But I can't promise that's true because I've never personally counted them. And in an average glass, there are about 9,800,000 bubbles, apparently.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much for that, Janine. I've always wanted to know that. And when you get bubble trains on the side of the glass, we call it a collarette. What a pretty name, a collarette. It's a sign of good champagne. Smaller bubbles also mean that the champagne is smoother and more refined. And did you know that champagne is more bubbly in a flute than in a coupe? Because the long, narrow shape of the flute, the glass, helps to preserve the bubbles and keep them from escaping, because they do sometimes escape. All those bubbles create a lot of pressure. It's about 90 pounds per square inch in a standard bottle of champagne, three times the pressure in a car tire, or roughly the same air pressure as the tires of a double-decker bus. So it's no wonder that opening a champagne bottle results with such a bang. There you go. A champagne cork can apparently reach up to 50 miles an hour when popped. The pressure pushes the cork out when the wire cage is removed. It's quite dangerous to drink champagne.
It's very dangerous because it's a strange fact. Apparently, an eye watering, 20% of eye injuries in the US are due to champagne bottle cork accidents. Oh my God. I'm always really careful to aim the bottle into a safe space because, you know, you don't want a cork in your eye. When I open a bottle, I loosen the metal cage and then I hold it down to control the cork and stop it zooming off as you twist the bottle. And if I think it's going to be a really big pop, because some are, I'll always put a cloth over the top to stop it jetting into space. Better to be safe than sorry, I think.
And another fun fact, I love those fun facts. The longest recorded champagne cork flight is about 177 feet. Yes, this Guinness World Record was set by Emeritus Heinrich Medicus in June 1988 at the Rootbury Vineyards Winery in New York.
Wow. I have to say, unlike with wine, we do have a better idea of when champagne began. Legend has it that Dom Pérignon, a monk at the Abbey of Hautevillers in Champagne, accidentally invented a sparkling wine in the 1600s and absolutely thrilled with the taste of it. He called out, "Brothers, come quickly, I'm drinking the stars." Well, the true part is that there was a monk called Dom Pérignon and he did work as cellar master at the Abbey of Hautevillers for the most of his life. And he was responsible for acquiring more vineyards and for improving the Abbey's non-sparkling wines. However, his work was documented and there was no mention of him ever making sparkling wine, either accidentally or on purpose. And even worse, some wine historians, I don't know if to whisper this, I don't know if to say it at all, actually. Some wine historians claim that the méthode champenoise was actually used in England more than 100 years before the French.
Oh, la, 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 la. No, 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 no. It can't be true. It's French, Janine, I'm telling you.
Da-da-da-da-da. No, it's not. They say champagne is English.
Stop saying that. That's enough now. Okay, yes, it could be true indeed. In fact, in Dom Pérignon's day, the bubbles were seen to be a fault. An early production method made it very prone to accidents, with bottles exploding literally a lot in the cellars. But Dom Pérignon helped to standardize champagne production methods and added the two safety measures to his champagnes, a rope snare that kept corks in place, important, and thicker glass bottles that could withstand more pressure.
It's amazing because we're so used to seeing those metal cages, you know, the cages things on top of the bottles. But I went to a really great museum in Champagne called Pressoria, and they had old bottles there, and the corks used to be tied on with string until quite recently. I was amazed by that. No wonder they all exploded. You could just imagine it all over the place in the cellars. But anyway, even if it was the English that first invented champagne, knowing this doesn't at all spoil the taste and the feeling you get when you sip a glass of champagne. Some 300 million bottles a year are produced. They're left to mature for at least 15 months and they ferment twice, and that's what gives it the bubbles, in hundreds of miles of underground cellars. Champagne is exported to more than 190 countries. And after the French, the Americans are the biggest consumers of champagne. They're followed by the British, with Winston Churchill setting a great example by drinking an estimated 42,000 bottles in his
Good
lifetime.
man.
Wow. Just astonishing. They like to be served champagne at 11 a.m. precisely every day. And Paul Roget was his favourite. And that's also the champagne served at royal events, including the wedding of Prince William and Kate Middleton, and Prince Harry and Meghan Markle.
And lots of famous people have loved champagne. James Bond drinks champagne 65 times in the books. It's not all about the martinis, shaken, not stirred, you know. Bollinger is James Bond's official champagne, apparently.
And Marilyn Monroe was said to have poured 350 bottles into her bathtub for a bubble bath. Coco Chanel once said, "I only drink champagne on two occasions, when I'm in love and when I'm not."
And Napoleon was a fan. He said, "In victory, you deserve champagne. In defeat, you need it."
I actually went to the Moët & Chandon cellars in Épinay in Champagne, and they have one of his famous tricorn hats there because apparently he left it behind when he visited. That's a great story. There are more than 160 miles of champagne cellars underneath the towns of Epernay and Reims, or as the French say it, Reims, with hundreds of millions of bottles fermenting ready to be popped.
And did you know that tradition of sabrage, opening a champagne bottle with a sword, is said to have been invented by Napoleon's troops? Yes, the story goes that they would open bottles of champagne with their swords to celebrate their victories, and they were pretty much showing off by lopping the tops of the bottles off with their swords. It takes a lot of practice to get it right. Don't do that at home. You have to strike just beneath the cork and the chop so that the cork and the neck of the bottle fly off into the air, leaving the bottle intact.
Absolutely, do not try this at home, folks. If you've ever seen Emily in Paris, you'll probably remember Camille's dad trying it and cutting his finger off in the process. Oh, yuck.
Okay, so let's talk about something else, a little bit about drinking etiquette in France. You know, we love our etiquette. But first, did you know that a drink at a bar in France is cheaper than a drink at the table?
It is, and in France, it's also customary to wait until everyone has arrived before you take your first sip, whether that's one person or 50. I was once invited to a party in a restaurant, and my husband and I got there first, and we didn't know then that it was de rigueur to arrive a little bit late.
Yes, it is. You know, le quart d'heure de politesse, another etiquette thing. It's okay to be a quarter of an hour late.
It is, but we're British, so we're always on time or early. So we were shown to our seats at the table. The waiter dashed off without taking our order for drinks, which we thought was a bit odd because where we're from in London, they take your drink order straight away. Anyway, another couple arrived and we shook hands, didn't kiss them because we didn't know them. They sat down. Again, the waiter didn't ask any of us if we wanted a drink, which we thought, oh, this is a bit odd. More and more people arrived, and we all either shook hands or kissed on the cheek. And by now, we were quite thirsty, and we didn't even get a glass of water. But as soon as the last person was seated, the waiter scooted over and rapidly completed drinks orders for everyone. It's just a thing in France. Drinks when everyone has arrived, not before.
And do you know, when drinking with French friends, it's considered polite to clink glasses, and there are a few rules when doing so wait for it. First, you must keep eye contact with everyone as you clink your glasses. And second, you should wait for everyone to finish clinking and staring into each other's eyes before you drink. It doesn't matter if it's alcohol or non-alcoholic drink. And if you're wondering why the French require you to look into their eyes as you toast each other, it's said that failure to do so will result in 7 years of bad luck, or even worse, bad sex. And also, don't cross the glasses. It's bad luck too.
Know that. No, you weren't supposed to cross glasses. I'm sure I've done it a lot. Oh God. Bad luck coming my way. It really makes me laugh when people do that in France and they stare so intently into your eyes. Apparently, this whole custom goes back to the Middle Ages when you had a drink with someone you didn't know very well and you weren't sure if they were friends or enemies and might poison your drink. So you had to watch them really intently to make sure that they didn't slip poison into your drink. There you go.
Just so you know. Important things in this
Yes.
podcast,
Well, we know all the facts here.
Yeah. And finally, when you have a drink in France with a friend or family, it's common to say à ta santé or just santé, which means to your good health. And you answer by saying à la tienne, to yours. And if you're wanting to be a bit more formal, like with your boss, you say à votre santé, to your good health, answered by à la vôtre, to yours.
I always keep it really simple and just say chin chin, which is like cheers.
But now, as with every episode, it's time for a listener's question. Got a question about France? Well, ask the experts. We reply to you in each episode. And we do it for free. So, Janine, what's today's question?
It's a fun question today. It's from a lady called Sally Dulally. I think that might be a nom de plume, you know, pretend name, but that's what she calls herself, Sally Dulally from Cumbria, UK. And she wants to know, why do the French eat cheese before dessert when everyone else eats cheese after dessert? So, Ollie, what's the answer to that one, please?
Well, it's a good question to start with. We never really think much about why in France. It's just something we do, but I think there are several reasons. It's savory, so it goes with the savory courses rather than having savory starters, you know, main meal, then something sweet, then something savory again. It's a bit weird for us. Also, it's got a heavy fat content, so it's best at the end of the meal so it doesn't fill you up completely.
My French friend Isabel told me that, you know, typically you have coffee and tea at the end of the meal, and it makes the cheese solidify in your stomach. And that's another reason why you should have it before the dessert.
Yes, definitely. Also, cheese is best eaten at room temperature. So if you get it out of the fridge at the start, it will be perfect by the time you get through the rest of the meal. Just like wine is best decanted, cheese is best left to breathe.
I think that's probably the main reason, knowing the French, actually. Although I did also read somewhere that cheese is an alkali and desserts are generally acidic. And so apparently eating cheese as the last course is better for your teeth. I don't know if that's true, but maybe.
Maybe, yes.
Maybe.
And if you love cheese, have a listen to our Welcome to Cheeseland episode. Everything you want to know about French cheese and more. It's an episode that is a bit smelly, but really good. Full of facts.
A smelly episode. Thanks, Ollie. So there you have it, Sally Dulally. Love that name. There are very good reasons for having cheese at the end of the meal.
Thanks so much for that question, Sally Dulally. Perhaps that is a real name. Never know. If you also have a question for us, feel free to send it to janine@thegoodlifefrance.com or via our podcast newsletter. And if there is a topic you want to know more about, let us know. This is the Good Life France podcast. Oh là là! Le podcast The Good Life France. Thank you so much. A massive merci beaucoup to everyone for listening to our podcast from almost 150 countries all around the world. And huge thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends and family. We're truly grateful when you do that. You've been listening to Janine March and myself, Olivier Geoffrey. You can find me at parischanson.fr.
And you can find me and heaps of information about France, where to visit, culture, history, recipes, everything France, at thegoodlifefrance.com, where you can subscribe to the podcast, my weekly newsletter about France, and our totally brilliant, totally free magazine, which you can also read at magazine.thegoodlifefrance.com. But for now, it's au revoir from me.
And goodbye from me.
Speak to you soon.
The Good Life France podcast. Available on all podcast platforms, on thegoodlifefrance.com and on parischanson.fr. The most beautiful French songs of the 40s, 50s and 60s, only on Paris Chanson. Available on your mobile, smart TV, computer and smart speaker 24/7. Visit parischanson.fr to find out more. That's parischanson.fr.